Welcome to Swiss Uduk. My name is Hans Fischer and my guest is Jan Irving. Welcome, Mr. Irving. How much of your own life is in Until I Find You?
I think I'm the slowest writer I know. That is, I always like to be very far away from something. I wrote my Vietnam novel, Owen Meany, more than 20 years after the Vietnam War. I wrote my abortion novel, not in the present political atmosphere, the climate since the 1970s, but back in the 1930s and 40s. I made it a historical story. I always liked this telescopic lens, maybe, is how you say it. And most writers I know, if they're going to be autobiographical, it'll be the first novel or the second novel. Most writers write about their childhood and their teenage years when they're only in their 20s or 30s. For some reason, I felt more comfortable to wait until I was much older before giving a character in a novel a fast dieselbe characteristics of my own childhood and adolescence, so that when something is directly autobiographical, it's so much in the past that I'm looking at myself as a kid and a teenager as if I'm somebody else. It's a good way to distance yourself, to make some distance, but I'm not an actor. The idea was always to make this character as a child and as a young man more comfortable being anybody else than he's comfortable being him. As a child, he's a very present character, but the older he gets, he almost disappears. There is no Jack Burns except the people he plays. He's more vivid in his roles, even as a woman, then he's kind of present as a personality. I wanted his mother to also be this kind of character, that when we first meet her in the act one, we not only feel we know who she is, she's a little eccentric, but we don't think she's a bad mother. We like Alice. And we don't think Jack can have a terrible childhood. He sees some things maybe some children shouldn't see, but we're not worried about him, really. It's only later that his mother also disappears. The more we know Alice, the less we know. So that when she dies, we know her less well than we thought we knew her when Jack was 4 years old. Well, I wanted those, you know, those aspects to reflect episodes, issues, things that I grew up with. I needed to imagine a missing father because I didn't know mine. But what you do as a fiction writer with things in your real life that have troubled you or that become like obsessions, that you visit them again and again, you keep visiting them, is you either turn them into a kind of wishful thinking. You either turn them into things you wish had happened to you, or you make them worse than they were. In either case, you exaggerate. In other words, I never met my father, so I let Jack meet his. I was always afraid that my father was a bad guy, and that's why no one would talk to me about him. So I make William crazy, but a good guy, a lovable guy. Well, that's a kind of manipulation of a life that didn't happen to me. Emma Osler is by far the most sympathetic character in this novel, but she's familiar to readers of my earlier novels. She's Hester in Owen Meany. She's Melanie. It's always the same bigger, older, stronger, sexually aggressive young woman who, when you first meet her, looks like she's trouble for the younger, smaller male main character. But in the end, She's a kind of angel. She's a kind of protector. But when you first meet her, you don't think so. I've made up such a character in three books. It's a little bit autobiographical that there was no such person in my life, but I think probably I wanted her. I think as a kid growing up, I wished I had known a Melanie, a Hester, an Emma. It would have been nice, right? Then the other way you change reality in fiction is you make it worse. I was 11 when I had my first sexual experience with a very nice young woman in her 20s. Everybody who knew her would have thought she was almost normal, right? But everyone likes her, me too. I made Jack 10, and Mrs. Machado, 20 years older, she's 40, she's already abused two of her own children, and she's a kickboxer. Well, I've known some women kickboxers, but I never slept with them. So, you know, I think that when you write something that's emotionally, psychologically from your own life, you have to find a way to make the details new. Because as this book teaches you, you can't rely on your memory. Your memory isn't good enough. And so what you think you remember of an experience, you better wait a long time before you try to make it alive as fiction. And you have to find a way to make it new and to change the detail in some degree. The effects it has on you emotionally, psychologically, this is the same. You try to be truthful to what this did to you or what this experience meant to you. You also see that better 20, 30, 40 years later than you might 10 years after the fact. But something about the detail has to be fresh. And that's where you have to be able to add your imagination to the autobiographical experience, I think.
Was it painful for you to revisit your past?
The sexual subject, no. The missing father subject, yeah. Because I was three quarters of the way through this book in December of 2001 when I heard from this guy who said, I think I might be your brother. And I had suddenly all this information about a father I didn't have much information about. Well, it was good for the novel because I always begin with the ending. I already had written the scene at the St. Peter's Kirk, the construction workers celebrating Williams' concert. I already knew that Jack is going to find his father. Jack is going to love his father. Everybody loves his father except Alice. And that his father is verrucht. So to learn from my brother in 2001, when I have a couple more years to go writing this book, and I've already been writing it since 1997, to find out that he's dead and that I never meet him was not necessarily the good news for me.
If the novel is so much autobiographical, why didn't you write it in the first person?
I wrote it, I don't think I could have, because I felt so close to Jack Burns. The childhood stuff, the sexual stuff, the missing father, the mother business. I don't think I could have written the book the first time except in the first person voice. It felt like a first person novel to me because of how close I felt to this character. But when I had rewritten it many times in that voice, I felt that it would be better if I could make the reader step back, when you never can do that with a first-person voice. You're always up to here. It's always a close-up. And in the past, I don't like the first-person voice except as a last choice. In the case of Hotel New Hampshire, where the guy is in love with his sister, it seems to me with that kind of an obsession, I had to be in the voice of the person who was obsessed. Had to be. In the case of Owen Meany, where you're claiming that this character had foreknowledge of his own death and that it's a kind of religious experience, you have to be in the you have to see that story in the Augen of the believer, the guy who believes in it. And so I needed Johnny Wheelwright to tell that story. And I thought that was the case with this book, that because I always know more about the ending and the beginning of a novel than I know about the middle. I believe the middle can take care of itself, or I never change the ending of a novel. I sometimes change the first chapter. The most number of changes in terms of making chapter 5, chapter 10, or chapter 12, chapter 6, that kind of editing, the moving pieces around, that only happens in the middle of the story. And when I first imagined this novel, I thought the main characters were William and Alice, because William is the dominant force in Act 5. He's what's waiting at the end of the book. And you begin the story with Alice and Jack's adoration of his mother. I underestimated how important Emma was and Mrs. Oster was and the whole Hollywood story that marks the middle of Jack's journey. And I underestimated how much I liked the psychiatrist, Dr. Garcia, and how I wanted to give her more to do, more to have with the story. But the most important thing was, in the first person voice, you know from the first sentence that he's talking to a psychiatrist. I thought this, it gave too much away. I told the reader too much in that first person voice, and I thought I could hide the story better. I was afraid that in that voice, you would be too conscious of, wait a minute, how can a four-year-old remember this kind of detail? I thought I would give it away. This is the false memory. This is the memory that the mother has somehow manipulated or implanted. By making it a third-person voice, I think it's a surprise to most readers that the childhood you take for granted in part one is not what really happened. You can always hide things better, conceal things better in the third-person voice. And you get to back up. It has that telephoto lens effect. So I don't think it could have happened any other way. I mean, I think I had to write it in the first person first, and I had to put it in the third person in order to really finish the novel. When it was done and I'd rewritten it a bunch of times, I actually sent it off to my editor in New York. And she had just started to read it a second time. They'd read it the first time. She'd made an offer on the book, and she said she wanted to start it a second time. And I said, send it back. It's not, you know, can't have it. You know, and she thought I was crazy. She thought... she said, I love it. What are you going to change it for? And I said, just wait. Just give me a chance. So all I did was send her the first chapter in the third person voice. I just changed the first chapter and I sent her the first chapter, and she said, you're right. But she was anxious. People who'd read the book in the first person voice, when I told them, it's not right. It'll be better if I put it in the third person. They didn't think so. They said, no, don't do that. Because they like this kind of confessional. But I thought I could do both, because you may notice that when there's a first person plural, I kept the we in. So I left every first person plural sentence, I left in that sentence, because it works with the third person. It, instead of meaning, because when a writer says we, it means the same thing for a first person narrator as it does in an omniscient voice. It means humankind, all of us.
How did you prepare to get all the information for your accurate descriptions?
Well, I like research. I love it. I like, it feels like becoming a student again. It's like you go back to school to learn about something. And the more I don't know about it, the more attracting it is. I loved organ music. I always have. I love the sound of that a big organ in a big church makes. But I didn't know it really well, and I didn't know any organists. So it was exciting to go to Oslo and Stockholm and Copenhagen and Zurich and to hear and basically say, please play for me. You know, give me your 10 favorites, your 10 top hits. It's a small world, the organ world. I mean, you can be in Finland, you can be in the Netherlands, you can be in Switzerland, and you ask an organist to play you his or her 12 favorite pieces, 10 of them will be the same. They really will. 10 of them will be the same. And you always pretend that you never heard this before, you know. Someone says, have you heard the Bach Staccato and Fugue in D minor? No. And so it's very exciting. And they always talk about how bad the organ in another church is, or, you know, how this is the best organ in the best church. And it's very interesting. They're very obsessive people. Any musician has to be. Think of the hours you have to be alone with your instrument. But they always told me the same story, these guys, that they were piano players, right? They had piano lessons. They played the piano, sometimes for years. And one day, by accident, they were in a church, and the organist or their mother or their father said, my son plays the piano, but he's never played. And one day they touched that keyboard, because they know how to play, at least not with their feet yet, but they can play with their hands. One day they touch that thing, and oof, they hear that big sound come back at them, and they're addicted. That's it. One time. And they can never go back to play the piano. It either happens or it doesn't. If you're a piano player, you touch the organ, you think, oh, that's too loud. Too loud, you go away, you know. But everyone told me the same story, that it was instantaneous, whether they were 9 years old or 29 years old. It didn't matter. Just first time, that was it. Changed their life. And I'm fortunate that I have so many publishers in different parts of the world, so that when I knew I needed to meet a tattoo artist and a couple of organists in Helsinki, I could speak to my Finnish publisher and say, can you ask around and find two or three people who are willing to spend some time with me and give me some time and let me just stay with them for a week and follow them around like a dog. It's easier with the tattoo artists than the organists, because the tattoo artists are very social guys. They tell stories all the time. They're always talking to people. It takes a long time to get some tattoos. And so they'll tell you the story of their life in 10 minutes and anything else you want to know. They're very accessible. But organists, like other musicians, they don't like to talk a lot. They love to play for you. They'll play for you as long as you want to listen. And I always try to say, there's a story of this man. He's never satisfied with this organ. He's never satisfied with that woman. He's always moving. How do you find him? How do you track him down? How would you know him? And, of course, this was also better in a third-person voice. If William Burns is a tattoo addict, and most of his tattoos are music, every tattoo artist who's ever tattooed him knows where he at least was going when they last saw him, right? Everyone knows him. If you're a gifted organist and you play for a while and then move on, everyone in the church you played knows the next church you've gone to. They all know each other. So that in a way, if Alice were telling the truth, that they're looking for his father, William Burns would be the easiest man to find you can imagine. You know, anyone could find William Burns. But a four-year-old is gullible of, he'll believe anything. You can tell a four-year-old anything. And it was only important that Jack Burns never see another four-year-old or get to know another four-year-old in his most of his adult life until he's the second time in Helsinki and he meets the son in his hotel room from the pregnant aerobics instructor and he realizes that's a four-year-old. This kid will never remember a moment of that night unless somebody tells him. He just have no idea. That's the first time he realizes that his childhood is an invention. That research was really important. I made three trips to those Baltic and North Sea towns between 97 and 2003. It's also important, of course, that you find a reader in each of those countries, someone who will read the manuscript and who'll say, I'm sorry, this street in Helsinki goes that way. So you just, those little kind of things, they're fussy, stupid little things, but they really, those are I love details. I love details. The more, the better. And so I like becoming a kind of a collector of those details is really important to me. You can't do that without making mistakes, and the best you can hope is that by the time it's a paperback, your translators all over the world will have found the last of the mistakes, because there's going to be some. There's always going to be some. But I've been lucky so far. By the time the paperback is published, the translators find things that the editor in your own language misses, because translating is so exact that you can count on the translators will find something after the English language book is in hand. They're going to find something every time.
Thank you very much.